This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. The Supreme Court begins its new term on Monday and will take up a variety of intriguing issues this year. The nine justices who have served together now for 10 years will get right down to business. On their first day, they'll hear oral arguments in one of the most closely watched cases on the docket, the constitutionality of the federal sentencing guidelines. Later in the session, they'll take up cases involving the medical use of marijuana, whether minors should get the death penalty, and whether police can use drug-sniffing dogs during routine traffic stops. And as there's been for the last few years, there's talk about who might retire at the end of this term, given the advanced ages of some of the justices. But in this election year, the issue has taken on greater significance. We'll talk more about this on Monday in a second show about the Supreme Court. But today, we'll focus on the most important cases pending before the court, and we want to hear from you. What do you think of the issues before the Supreme Court? Maybe there are others we haven't mentioned you'd like to talk about. Give us a call. The number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. With us this hour are two legal experts. Kathleen Sullivan is a constitutional law professor and until recently dean of Stanford Law School. Welcome, Professor Sullivan.
Thanks very much.
And John Yu is a professor at the Law School of the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome, Professor Yu.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Professors Sullivan and you are both joining us from Philadelphia, where they're getting ready for an event tonight at the National Constitution Center about the Supreme Court. So let's start with you, Professor Sullivan. There are 48 cases on the Supreme Court's docket. Which is the most important one, in your opinion?
Well, as a practical matter for the federal courts, Joe, the big case is the one you've already mentioned that's being argued on Monday, and that's the case about whether judges can add years to a criminal defendant's sentence based on facts outside those found and convicted by the jury. Those are the Booker and Fanfan cases being argued on Monday. But there are also several cases involving the role of the states in the federal union, and I hope we'll get to those.
And why is that such an important case?
Well, the sentencing guidelines were a huge political compromise that we came to almost a generation ago. It was a joint exercise by liberals and conservatives. Liberals wanted sentencing guidelines for judges to make sentences fair and make sure there was no race or other form of discrimination in the way discretionary sentences were allocated, whereas conservatives liked the sentencing guidelines because they thought it would lead to more law and order, longer sentences. And we've lived with those sentencing guidelines now for many, many years. The federal courts have relied on them, prosecutors have relied on them, and the prison system has been built around them. Now, last term, the Supreme Court threw all of that into doubt with a case called Blakely against Washington. That was a case in which an unusual majority of the Supreme Court, justices who usually don't join together, you had three liberal justices plus Justices Scalia and Thomas, often thought of as conservative, they all said together that Washington cannot send a person to a greater sentence in prison than what was permissible for the offense the jury found. In other words, they said that the original Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial means that no one can go to jail unless, as Justice Scalia put it, the government goes to the mild inconvenience of putting him to a jury trial for that defense.
Right, I remember offense. That line. I thought that was Scalia does have a way of turning a phrase, does he not?
Colorful, absolutely. But the question was, what does that mean for the federal sentencing guidelines? The Washington law was struck down in Washington state, but many people, including the dissenting justices, the vigorous dissents by, among others, Justices Breyer and O'Connor in the Blakely case, predicted that as goes Washington, so would go the federal sentencing guidelines, which permit judges to add years to a sentence. Let's look at Mr. Booker, whose case will be argued on Monday. Alleged drug kingpin. He could have gone to jail under the statute, to prison under the statute, for 10 years to life. The jury found him guilty of a crime for which, under the sentencing guidelines, he could have gone to prison for 20 years to life. But the judge in the separate sentencing hearing said, I found you actually had more cocaine in your duffel bag than the jury found. So I'm going to look at you under I'm going to depart upward, and I'm going to give you 30 years to life. Mm. I'm going to find a sentence there. So the issue is whether the judge can add on years to the sentence without finding by a jury. So unusually, Justice Scalia here was kind of the poster boy for the American Civil Liberties Union or the National Criminal Defense Bar, saying that the original Constitution means you have to have a jury trial that is the basis on which you're sent to prison. A judge can't, on his own discretion, make it up. Now, the outcome of this case will determine not only what sentences can be given in the future, but may have an effect on existing prison sentences.
Well, I think we're clear now on why it's an important case. Professor Yu, do you agree that this is the most important case?
Yeah, in terms of the number of people it affects, you're talking about tens of thousands of people who have sentences under the sentencing guidelines. Also, the thing to keep in mind is if the court does strike down the sentencing guidelines, which by all accounts it looks like it will, given that the federal system is almost identical to the state system that was struck down last year, there's not going to be any rules that are really going to constrain the discretion of judges after the decision and how they sentence defendants. So we'll be back to a world where judges have pretty large discretion. As you know, Kathleen just said, some of the sentences here are from possible ranges are 15 years to life. And a judge could say life and another judge could say 15 years. And you know, we'll be back into a world where it'll be up to each individual judge in different states. They're all federal judges, but you could have very disparate sentences spread throughout the country for people who essentially commit the same crimes.
So will it be possible, will it be necessary to, if the society, let's say, decides that sentencing guidelines are a good thing, is this something that has to be addressed by the legislative branch, or is there a way still to do it with, within the court system?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think one of the things, one of the other lessons perhaps about the whole sentencing guidelines experience is the same we learned from the independent counsel statute. I don't know what Kathleen thinks about this, so I'd be curious. But in the late 80s, we did some things, and we, like creating the Sentencing Commission, which made up all these guidelines. We had an independent counsel that was created around this same time. And most people thought, these are funny things to do. They seem to run into the separation of powers. But the Supreme Court allowed them on behalf of, you know, very good purposes. And now, you know, we're kind of learning the lesson that the separation of powers might have been a good thing to stick with. So I think in this case, we're probably not going to have a commission made up of judges and legislators and prosecutors, which was the commission that had been headed by then Judge Breyer, to decide these guidelines. Instead, I think we're going to have to go back to Congress and have laws passed that are going to set out sentencing ranges in a little more detail than, say, 15 years to life or 20 years to life.
Well, I should perhaps ask Professor Sullivan, do you have a different take on that, or do you think Professor Hugh has characterized it the proper way?
Well, there's always going to be discretion somewhere in the criminal justice system. If it right now, the discretion of judges has been constrained by the guidelines. But it used to be that there was discretion in the parole system. It would be effectively the parole authorities in the prison who would decide whether somebody got out at 10 years, 20 years, or 30 years for the same offense. There will always be discretion in the criminal justice system. The question is, who should really be cabining it? And Congress did to some extent pass the buck in the sentencing guidelines to this expert commission. And no expert commission can necessarily come up with the perfect sentence for any crime so that the punishment fits the crime. That's something that may take people closer to the case, like a judge, or closer to the prisoner, like the parole system. So a restoration of some discretion to back elsewhere in the criminal justice system wouldn't be a terrible thing. In fact, many federal judges would very much appreciate the return to discretion on their part, since they feel they can assess all the factors before them. But it will, in any event, throw us into turmoil unless there's some clear resolution of this from the Supreme Court.
We're talking with Professors Kathleen Sullivan of Stanford and John Yu of Berkeley Law School, Bolt Hall, about the cases before the next Supreme Court session, which starts on Monday, and we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And let's take a call now from Catherine in Lakeside, California. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I have a question. Well, first I have a comment. I was in federal prison for 6 years. Okay, and unfortunately, I was under a 922G, which was a felon in possession of firearms. Okay, I had to plead out to that charge in order not to get 30 years for marijuana. Okay, people don't realize out there that there are people in prison right now that are doing a lot of time under the federal guidelines, okay, the sentencing guidelines. Right. It's unfortunate and unfair that judges don't have as much discretion as they need. Let's say if you were in prison for murder, you know, it would be a different thing because you would have more of a chance and opportunity for sentencing by a jury. But in the feds, if you look at the conviction rate, 85% of them, of people go ahead and just plead out so that they don't get more time if they go to trial by jury.
So did you have a question also, or was that...
Yeah. Well, that's a comment. That's my first comment. My question would be, would the judges be able to depart downward as well as a result of them being able to depart upward?
Good question, Catherine. Thank you very much. Perhaps I can ask Professor Sullivan. Does that have an easy answer?
Well, Catherine raises a number of really important points. Judges can still depart downward. Nothing in Booker or Fanfan is about downward departures, where judges are more merciful than the jury. It's about where judges are more tough than the jury. So downward departures are still not directly affected by this ruling. But Catherine raises two very important points. One, she talks about pleading out. Well, in fact, the sentencing guidelines, many people think, have really shifted power from judges to prosecutors, because the prosecutors can use the threat of the big sentence to bring about a plea to a lesser charge. So the real question here is, where should power reside in our system, with the executive branch or more with the judicial branch in deciding what punishment fits the crime? And those who are against the guidelines might say better with judges than with prosecutors. And the second point she reminds us of is that there's another issue in the criminal justice system, and that's mandatory minimums. Nothing in these cases is going to resolve the question of whether we've got sentences that at their minimum are too high for the crime, sending too many, for example, drug offenders or offenders who haven't committed any violence against others into the federal prison system. And the mandatory minimums have been criticized by no less than a figure than Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court, a moderate Republican appointee of President Reagan's. So nothing in this case will really affect either downward departures or the other big issue of mandatory minimums.
All right. Thanks for that. There's another important case on the docket. I guess it's Roper v. Simmons, the constitutionality of the death penalty for juveniles. Professor Yu, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what that case involves.
This is a case that raises the question of whether people who are 16 or 17 years old when they committed a crime and so hence are legally juveniles can be executed for those crimes when the execution itself takes place when they're 18 or older. And this is a case, an issue that the Supreme Court decided in a case called Stanford versus Kentucky, and hadn't been reexamined until now. The thing that's really prompting the reexamination of this is a case from two terms ago called Virginia versus Atkins, in which the court said, again reversing itself, that the execution of the mentally retarded was unconstitutional. For I think roughly 10 years or a little more than 10 years, it had been held to be constitutional by the court. And in that Atkins decision, the court laid out this approach to figuring out when there was what it called, quote unquote, a national consensus that a certain death penalty practice was unconstitutional. In the mentally retarded case, the court looked at how many states had the death penalty, and then those that had the death penalty, how many states still allowed the execution of the mentally retarded. It'll probably undertake, I assume, the exact same analysis here. So they'll ask, how many states allow the execution of minors? How many states don't? How many have the death penalty? Just the figures, the last time I looked, were of the 38 states that allow the death penalty, 18 states do not allow the execution of minors. So I suspect the court's going to go towards reversing itself and prohibiting execution of minors.
Okay, we have to take a short break. We're talking about what's on the Supreme Court docket this year, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. The Supreme Court opens its new term on Monday. We're talking about some of the most closely watched cases with Kathleen Sullivan, a constitutional law professor at Stanford Law School, and John Yu, a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley, Bolt Hall Law School. You're invited to join the discussion. Which cases will you be watching? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And I have here an email from Janice in Oklahoma City, who writes, I understand the court has agreed to accept a case challenging the constitutionality of the use of economic development as the public purpose justification for eminent domain and condemnation. Perhaps Professor Sullivan, you can tell us a little bit about that case.
Well, that's absolutely right. Just this week, the court granted review in a case from New London, Connecticut. And at issue in that case is whether New London can come along and look at a group of houses and say, well, this property with these ramshackle houses could be turned to much more profitable use by developers. We could have a company industrial park come in and not only create a much better looking use of this land, but give us a lot more tax base for the city. And of course, cities and municipalities all over the country look at whether they might improve their tax base and their economic prosperity and public fisc by taking land in eminent domain, the takings power, and then turning it over to private companies for development. Now, this is something that has actually happened and been held constitutional for half a century. Back in 1954, in a case called Berman against Parker, the Supreme Court said that if the city takes your property and turns it over to a developer to get rid of urban blight, that's all right, even though it's taking your land and giving it to another private party. Now, why might that be a constitutional issue? The Constitution says that the government shall not take your property for public use without just compensation. It's one thing if the government comes along and takes my house in order to build City Hall or to build a new highway. But if the government comes along and takes my house and resells it to Donald Trump or the Pfizer company, or as Michigan once tried to do, take property from so-called Poletown, a Polish community, and sell it to GM, is that for public use or is that for private use? Well, back in 1984, the Supreme Court again said, even if the government takes your land and resells it to another private party, that's all right. We defer to the government as the best judge of what's in the economic interest of the city. That was a case called Hawaii Housing Authority versus Midkiff, in which I actually helped represent the state of Hawaii. Mm-hmm. So it would be a very, very big and radical step for the Supreme Court now to stop New London and say what Hawaii did in the 1984 case or what New York City did in the 1954 case is now not allowed under the Constitution. And yet that's just what the Michigan Supreme Court just did recently. They said it was wrong to take Poletown and give people's houses to GM. We've overruled ourselves. So it's a big issue about whether or not people's houses can be taken to be given to a private developer.
But, you know, for me at least, this raises the question of why is this U.S. Supreme Court getting involved in what sounds like a state issue?
Well, because the state court, the Connecticut Supreme Court, ruled under the United States Constitution's Fifth Amendment, which says no property shall be taken for public use without just compensation. So the Connecticut court, in a way, put that the United States Constitution in issue, unlike the Michigan Supreme Court, which in saying it had been wrong about Poletown and saying that private use is not a justification for taking your property in Michigan, they ruled under the Michigan Constitution.
Hmm. Well, there are two cases that are of interest to people who live in California, which you both do, as it happens. One is the medical use of marijuana, and the other is the shipment of wine across state lines. Tell us about those, Professor Yu.
Well, these are both what I can think of as Seinfeld cases. These are cases about, you know, irritating little things that a lot of people come across in their everyday lives. They're not huge cases of great constitutional import, but, you know, in terms of what people are actually going to deal with in their lives when they come across the Constitution, these things are pretty important. So the first case is, as you said, the medical marijuana case. And we have federal drug laws which prohibit the possession of marijuana. You know, your caller, Catherine, alluded to that. And this is a case where one woman who has medical problems is permitted under California state law to use marijuana to help her medical problems. Didn't buy the marijuana from anybody. She grew it herself. There's two cases. The other case is another California woman who the marijuana was grown for her and given to her. None of the marijuana comes from out of state. No money changed hands. And the question is whether Congress can make it a crime to possess marijuana under its powers over interstate commerce. And this is an really interesting case because it really puts, I think the five conservative – who are commonly thought as the five conservative justices, Rehnquist, O'Connor, Kennedy, Scalia, and Thomas, into a bit of a bind because they have, in other cases, invalidated federal criminal laws for going beyond the powers of Congress over the Commerce Clause. So they struck down the Violence Against Women Act in one case. They struck down the law that prohibited the possession of handguns in school zones. Now, this one's harder for them, I think, because generally these are the same justices who are give a lot of discretion to the prosecutors and law enforcement in combating crime. So we'll see whether they stick with the principles they've had about federalism and states' rights in the past and limitations on Congress, or whether they're going to go probably with their hearts, which would be with the people who have to fight the drug war. The other case is a case called Granholm, and this is a case about people who live in some states like Michigan and New York, I think are probably the most prominent ones, who are not allowed to buy wine from out of state and have it shipped directly to them. They have to buy it from in-state wholesalers or retailers. And this has been challenged as a violation of what's called the Dormant Commerce Clause. Generally, states are not allowed to erect protectionist barriers against imports. The thing, and normally, if this weren't liquor, I think this would be an easy case. If it had been like grain or cows
or
finished products,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, horseshoes,
right.
It'd be an easy case. But the problem is that this is alcohol, and after Prohibition, when Prohibition was repealed, the constitutional amendment still reserved to the states the power to control import or exports of liquor. So the question is, you know, these states don't place any kind of restrictions like this on in-state wineries. They do out-of-state wineries. So the question is the Constitution's grant of power over alcohol to the states when it repealed Prohibition, does that allow it to place these sort of discriminatory protectionist barriers on the imports of alcohol? Now, obviously, as you said, for California, this is a big interest, although I think the plaintiff in the Granholm case is called something like, you know, Chateau del Al or Chateau de Alfred. You know, there's some big, actually really big wine interests behind this suit, even though I think it's a funny little family winery that's actually brought the suit. This has a lot of economic impact, obviously, to California and Napa Valley.
I'm sure. And it seems like this one might be harder to handicap because I'm not sure unless there are justices who feel that New York State, you know, has some special reason for keeping its liquor sales in state.
Yeah, it's interesting. There have been, to the extent there, these liquor cases do come up every now and then. They're very interesting. They don't break down along the normal lines we've seen. Some justices, I think Chief Justice Rehnquist is probably the one who's most notable. This would give states a lot of power to control the sale of liquor or imported liquor or advertisers' liquor, whereas someone like Justice Thomas, who's generally seen as more conservative on social or criminal issues, he's actually been very protective of businesses, of commercial interests, of the ability to engage in interstate commerce in liquor free from state control. So it'll have some interesting, unpredictable vote breakdowns.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Let's see if we can hear what some of our listeners think are the interesting cases. Let's go to John in Providence, Rhode Island. John, welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
The case I think is probably, from my standpoint, and I can explain that, is the question of what the Americans with Disabilities Act, whether the provisions of Title III of that act can be applied to foreign flag cruise ships.
Huh. Are you familiar with that case, Professor Sullivan?
Well, the court just granted cert in that case, and it's to resolve that. It was actually a case brought in part by members of the Stanford Supreme Court Litigation Clinic, including my colleague Professor Pam Carlin. So it's a case that raises an issue of a circuit conflict. Protecting people in wheelchairs and with other disabilities happens on domestic cruise lines, even if they're in port. The question is, can they apply to foreign cruise lines? And the court has taken it to resolve a circuit conflict.
What does it mean by a circuit conflict?
That's when there are 12 federal appeals courts that decide the law, and they are subject to overrule by the Supreme Court, and sometimes the Supreme Court steps in to referee when they disagree with one another.
I see. So now, John, I'm curious to know, you said there's a special reason you have an interest in this topic. What is it?
I'm the vice chairman of the Governor's Commission on Disabilities in Rhode Island, and we're the state regulator for disability rights, and also by statute, the state's the public advocate for disability rights in the business community. And just looking at the potential impact of number one, how many people would be affected, not only in the United States, but the fact that foreign flag cruise ships, if this law gets to apply to them, will have to make their ships accessible to people who aren't Americans. So
yeah.
The impact of to disabled people, both in Europe and other countries where the ships cruise out of, I think makes it very interesting and really kind of a key case from a disability law standpoint.
Interesting. Well, John, thanks very much for the call. You know, it does make me wonder, though, and maybe I can ask both Professor Sullivan and you, but maybe starting with you, Professor Sullivan, with the Internet, and this is a sort of a more of a traditional case, but it seems to me that Supreme Court cases, well, for example, in the interstate sale of wine, but if you've got U.S. law pertaining to activities that could take place anywhere in the world, is this extending the reach of the Supreme Court? Has this new global interconnectedness made Supreme Court decisions even more influential internationally?
Well, that's a very interesting point. It's rare that they have such international impact as the foreign flag cruise ship case. But let's think about domestic impact and go back perhaps to the Wine Direct Shipping case, which is a fascinating case. And it can't be that good for California's image that the two cases coming out of California of most prominence are about pot and wine. But just focusing for a moment on what makes
them so... I don't
think it's
changing anybody's opinion, though.
That's why I moved there. Come on.
But they're exquisite cases in the difficulty they present for conservatives, because conservatives are often for states' rights, except when it comes to whether California can allow medical marijuana use if it's homegrown, or whether Oregon can permit physician-assisted suicide, or whether some states can allow gay marriage. So the appeal of states' rights and the role of local decision-making in the federal union is sometimes forgotten. Now, in this term, the court might have to look at this California homegrown marijuana case and say, well, actually, has the Congress exceeded its power here? And but in the wine shipping case, to go back to your internet question, this is a case in which the discriminatory ban against out-of-state wine shipments is so flagrantly against the usual principles of the federal union that we don't have trade protectionism. This is why the framers put the commerce power in the Congress and said that states can't have trade wars with one another the way we might have with a foreign nation. So what New York and Michigan have done is put a discriminatory ban at the border that, as John correctly said, wouldn't be allowed for anything other than alcohol. And the issue is whether the 21st Amendment is somehow gives states a free rein to drop out of the National Economic Union. And those arguing to challenge the ban are saying that the Commerce Clause must prevail over the 21st Amendment. Obviously, the 21st Amendment allows a state to stay dry if it prefers, and if it wants to have no wine shipments anywhere in the state, it can do so, but it can't allow Michigan wineries to ship, but bar California wineries from shipping to Michigan and New York residents. That's what's at stake at that case. But you've hit the nail on the head about what makes the case difficult. It's the Internet, and the notion it's what makes it great in the one sense. The Internet takes the National Economic Union from the 18th century and gives it much more reach, much more consumer choice through the Internet. And yet the Internet, of course, in some people's mind is what makes it dangerous, the idea that perhaps people out of state might buy too much over the Internet or kids might have access to it. These things are easily controlled. A kid might try to order wine on the Internet, although it's doubtful that teenagers looking for some fun on Friday night are going to order wine from Napa Valley that takes 3 days to get there.
No, response time still isn't there. I don't think so. We're talking with Kathleen Sullivan of Stanford Law School and John Yu of the University of California Berkeley Law School, Bolt Hall, about the new Supreme Court term coming up and the cases that they will be dealing with. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Professor Yu, did you want to add to that issue
Yes.
of the Internet?
Yeah, actually, I think this term, it's something that might run in the other direction. Your question was about, is the Supreme Court and its decisions having influence abroad? Is there more globalism or interconnectedness? And I think it is, but it's running in the other direction, the influence of foreign decisions and foreign law on our Supreme Court. And the case where that'll come clear is the case about the execution of minors, the Roper versus Sevens case we talked about before that's from Missouri. In that case, in the Atkins case I talked about before from 2 years ago, where the Supreme Court said that the execution of the mentally retarded was unconstitutional, it looked quite explicitly not just at the practice of states within the United States, it also looked at the practice and opinions of other countries, of international treaties, of international tribunals. And this is something that's becoming more prominent. Also, 2 years ago, the case of Lawrence versus Texas, the case that struck down a prohibition on sodomy. Again, the court looked there again at the opinions, legal practices of other countries. And I think, you know, this is something some of the justices clearly are interested in. It's something, you know, we're just starting to talk about in the legal academy. So I think it's a very important issue because traditionally we've been used to the Supreme Court interpreting our Constitution based on American materials and caring what American, the political systems had said about an issue. Some members of the Supreme Court want us to be more globally oriented, but at the same time they need to explain why is it that what foreign countries do have relevance to interpreting the American Constitution. So that's I think, something, a phenomenon that's growing. It's also something we're thinking about and need to have a, you know, bigger discussion about in our political system because it's becoming, I think, a new and a more important trend in the way the Supreme Court thinks about cases.
Okay. Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, we'll be talking Monday about the future of the Supreme Court, given that several retirements are possible at the end of this term. We only have, we have less than 2 minutes left in this segment, but I'd like to ask our guests for their take on whether we'll see any vacancies this year. Perhaps, Professor Yu, we could start with you.
Sure. I think so. I think I did a little calculation a few years ago about the average ages of justices and how long they'd served when they retired. And in the last century, justices, when they retire, are usually 70 years old, and they've been on the court about 15 years. So Justice Stevens next year is going to turn 85. Chief Justice Rehnquist is going to turn 81. I think Justice O'Connor is going to turn 75. Justices Stevens and Chief Justice Rehnquist will be on the court for about 30 years or more. Justice O'Connor will be on the court over about 25 years. So if you're just an actuarial type person, somebody looks like they're going to have to retire because you're reading the outer boundaries of just human endurance and longevity.
Okay, and Professor, we only have about a minute left, and I wanted to get a thought from Professor Sullivan before we have to end.
Well, I actually disagree with John. I actually don't see any vacancies coming up in the near future unless, God forbid, there's a death, because the court has been as stable as any court since 1823. And even though the justices are elderly, they're all still on top of their game and very attached to their jobs. So I don't think there's any need for anyone to give the seat to a new president for more than 2 years.
Okay. Well, we have to leave it there. Kathleen Sullivan is a constitutional law professor and former dean of Stanford Law School. John Yu is a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley. Thanks to you both. When we come back from a short break, baseball is slated to return to the nation's capital. But is D.C. ready? What makes a town a baseball town? You tell us. The number is 800-989-TALK, 800-989-8255. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.